Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Talking today with Joseph Coates. Joe Coates is a consulting futurist in Washington, D.C. He can be found on the web at josephcoates.com. Welcome, Joe.
Good to be with you, Dr. J.
And we met at a confab in Seattle a little while ago talking about the future of the human body and had a lot of interesting discussions with a lot of other interesting folks. First, though, I want to hear a little bit about how you got involved in futurism.
I've been doing this for about 40 years. Like many people who have been in it for 30 or 40 years or even longer, they came into it kind of sideways. They sidled into it from some other activity. I'm originally a chemist. I was working always in a group in the chemical companies I worked in called Exploratory, so you're interested in the future there. But I took a short-term job in Washington at one of the military think tanks, and there I was concerned with research and development money, what it was going for. And that's a very interesting futures problem because you can't spend a dollar on defense research today and expect it to have any effect in less than 15 years because of the slowness of the process. So you have to look at the question of what is the future field of conflict. And then I moved to the National Science Foundation where I helped start a project called Research Applied to National Needs. Same kind of problem. You spend your research dollar today, and it's going to have its effects in some future world. Then I went to the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment, which was set up as a futures think tank for the Congress. And then I decided about 22 years ago, I had enough of that. I wanted my own micro-miniature think tank. So I set up a firm called Coates & Jarrett, which was in business for about 22 years. And the kind of people that we dealt with are really large organizations, corporations, mostly the Fortune 100 and 200, all kinds of government from local up to international, trade associations, foundations, and so on. We always had organizations as our client. I really salivate over the prospects, though, of having one of those very flush billionaires wonder what he's going to do with his money when he's gone, because that's really a tremendous social opportunity. But in any case, that's the kind of way it goes. But I have to tell you something before we get off on the wrong tack. Being a futurist, my primary function is not to tell people what will happen. Telling people what will happen, or the probabilities and the likelihoods and so on associated with it, is only an instrumentality. It's the instrumentality for getting at something far, far more important. When you think of organizations of any sort, any type, they all have a history of failure. Sometimes, someplace, sometimes big, sometimes small, sometimes at the project level, sometimes the whole enterprise. And the thing that links all organizational failure together is that somebody at the top or a small group at the top had assumptions about the future that were unsound. So my primary role as a futurist is to help you become aware of what your assumptions are. And the obvious thing is, well, why don't you ask? Because the most important assumptions you have are so deep-seated that you're probably not even aware of them yourself. And so we use the study of the future, the anticipations of what will happen, as essentially a provocation to evoke from you, oh, no, that'll never happen. Women never could. You're absolutely crazy to think that the Chinese could ever. You know, those are the kinds of things you want to get out of your look at the future, because when you ask that person, hey, George, could you develop a little bit more about why you're indisposed to that view about China? If he takes the bait, he has revealed some assumptions about the future. Now you have something worth talking about. So anyway, that's a little briefing on the enterprise.
But you do have strong opinions, and you're in this book of yours, which is called 2025, Scenarios of U.S. and Global Society Reshaped by Science and Technology. You do rank projections and ideas about the future in terms of their probability.
Oh, sure. And all of that is very serious stuff. And it's intended to help the reader, or if the reader were a client, it would be intended to help that person think through what the implications of those relatively high, relatively low probability, rather soon, rather later developments mean for their enterprise. And we, of course, help them do that as well. I didn't mean to carry the impression that when we're trying to provoke the client, that it's just provocation for provocation's sake. Oh, no.
Yeah, what if you've met unicorns, or what if angels descended from heaven?
Yeah, that's all nonsense. And, you know, you have a tremendous amount of nonsense coming along. And often it's in the guise or the aura, surrounded by the aura of very prominent people, you know, like people talking about implants in the brain right around the corner. We don't even know how the brain functions, and we're a far cry from figuring out. So the notion of having a computer-related gadget directly engage the brain has no thread of plausibility now.
Well,
now,
wait a minute.
Say it mightn't occur. That's not to say it mightn't occur 20, 30, 50, 100 years from now, but there are no tracks laid down now where you can say that is inevitable.
But you have that brain prosthesis as one of the technologies that you think are going to come up.
Oh, yeah. But you see, the brain prosthesis in some sense already exist. I mean, you put something in the brain of a Parkinsonian victim and moderate their Parkinsonian disorder. You put something into someone's mind or attach something to their skull and it breeds their alpha waves, and then they can be trained to operate something remotely that way. I mean, those kinds of things will go on. Those things will occur. But the thing that's so misleading in much of the literature about the future of computers and the brain is that there'll be some kind of lock-in that will carry complex memories or give you complex thinking protocols. It will give you detailed models, and they will become part of your higher cognitive functions. That's where there's nothing in the wind that says that's imminent. And I take imminent to be the next 10 to 25 years.
Do you think that there's a threshold beyond which it's not useful? I mean, I think I know where you're going to go with this question, because we were at the last meeting trying to talk about the next 1,000 years, and you were at one end of the continuum arguing that that was a useful enterprise. But don't you think that there is a diminishing threshold of talking about the future, given the complexity of interactions and unpredictability of things?
It depends on what you want to say and why you want to say it. For example, there's no question that the human species is evolving and will continue to evolve. The interesting questions about how fast and what it might evolve into are not terra incognita. It's not an area of unknown capabilities for useful speculation and conjecture. Because if you look at the pressures that will be on people and the fact that now we are the first species to be able to directly influence its own evolution because of our developments in genetics in the last 50 years, that opens up a whole world of interesting possibilities. For example, what I see in the next 1,000 years, which is about 44 generations, is that the capability to genetically influence people's development will first involve wiping out many diseases and disorders. Secondly, it will involve the prevention and the treatment of those things which it hasn't yet wiped out. Thirdly, it will move to what I call normalizing people, people who want to be like other people in some regard. They want to be taller. They want to be a little bit smarter. They want to be more witty, more engaging, where they want to be brought up to some closer to the average, or maybe a tad above the average. And then beyond that, the capabilities to deal with those conditions will all lead us into the capability for true human enhancement, to move individuals a big step ahead from where their antecedents had been. And that big step ahead may be in musical ability, it may be in imagery, it may be in writing, it may be in creativity in terms of mathematics and so on. It's not likely to be across the board, but I wouldn't preclude that. But as different people seek different changes, not just for themselves, but more importantly for their children, we may find over those 44 generations that we're beginning, and here I'll use the barnyard model, we're beginning to develop varieties which are distinctly different the way we have varieties of chickens, the varieties of cows, the varieties of sheep, the varieties of pigs. They're all pigs and chickens and sheep, but the varieties are distinctly different. And in 44 generations, we'll be seeing that happening with people. We may be at the steps immediately before speciation.
You're listening to Change Surfer Radio. This is Dr. J, and I'm speaking today with Joseph Coates. He's the author of 2025, Scenarios of U.S. and Global Society Reshaped by Science and Technology. Joe Coates is a consulting futurist in Washington, D.C. Joe, at the meeting that we were at, we also discussed the relevance of various science fictional universes and scenarios, and you were very adamant that you thought that that was a bad direction for a discussion to go about futurism. Don't you think that there is an overlap someplace between hard science fiction speculation and the kind of scenario building that you do?
Oh, yes, sure. There's an interface, maybe even a small overlap, but hardly bigger than the line of a lead pencil. The reason that the science fiction is misleading is that it makes clearly one or more counterfactual statements. And there's a fundamental principle in logic that if you allow one counterfactual, then anything else can happen. So the ability, for example, to engage in psychic experience, the ability to transform yourself from one place to another without any physical movement, these are the kinds of things that say, gee, once you could do that, the whole universe is going to change and be open to you. But it's not because those things shouldn't be said. It's because those things are fundamentally directed at entertainment. And fine, as entertainment, that's great. But most of the science fiction that introduces these utterly, utterly unthinkable, unimaginable, no root to capabilities can't be said, oh, we will. Now, on the other hand, a science fiction book called The Hammer of God by Arthur Clarke is just on the interface. The story, of course, is all fiction, and it's structured around the question of how would we deal with an impending asteroid hit. But the story itself is trivial and amusing and entertaining, but the account of how we would deal with that asteroid is very consonant with the kinds of serious scientific thinking today about how we will ultimately try to deal with a situation like that. So that's very clearly at that margin between science fiction and plausible extrapolation of what we think we know or can know. So, but by and large, most of it is irrelevant, and you see people really who haven't given any serious thought to the future saying, well, what about, I saw it on Star Trek. The other thing, of course, is that almost all science fiction is fundamentally negative. It's fundamentally the Western story, it's the knights in armor against the enemy and so on, and this shows up in their clothes. But more importantly, the characteristic of almost all science fiction is that it's negative, it's hostile, it's war, it's conflict. And what that tells you is something extremely important. It's almost impossible for most people to imagine a good, positive future that's fundamentally different from the one we live in. The most people can do, and this showed up at our meeting, is see the alleviation of present-day problems. You know, no more racism, no more genderism, a longer, healthier life, no more crime. Those aren't describing any particularly interesting world. What they're describing is the present world with some important things that we don't like, X out of it. So science fiction, again, is a bad model because its entertainment strength is essentially in the negative and the hostile and the conflicted.
One of the things I like about your book and your perspective is that is this optimism, and it's also an optimism that you have about democracy and the future of democracy, which, again, if you look at a lot of science fiction, you'd think that feudalism had a great future for itself.
Yeah.
You project in your book both that e-democracy, the various electronic forms of electronic participation and decision-making will proliferate, as well as global governance.
The global governance thing, I think you can say with apodictic certainty, that means without any reservation, for the following reason. If you think of our own country, the United States, we have a three-layer government. We don't have a seven-layer, we don't have a two-layer, we don't have a one-layer, we have a three-layer. And there's a fundamental reason for that. The bottom layer is local, where local people have the best opportunity to make the best decisions about issues that are strictly local. But then you see that there's a larger body that they're connected with. It might be what you call in some countries a province, what we call in the U.S. a state. And there are issues that are outside the scope of the individual communities, but do require attention. So we develop a kind of a state system. And then as the states proliferate, we see that there are other issues which have to cover a much wider universe of geography or of interest. And so we end up with our third layer of government, the central government. In our case, we call it a federal government. Now, all of that reflects the reality of the problems and the issues that come up. Now, with globalization accelerating in the last 100 years, we now have, on the global scale, problems that literally cannot be dealt with by the individual action of individual nations. And so what we're seeing is the slow evolution of global governance. Let me give you a perfect example of it working, and that's in the control of the radio spectrum. There is no problem of any first-order magnitude in regulating the radio spectrum. Why? Because every country in the world recognizes one thing. If we don't regulate it, nobody has radio or television or anything else electronic. So the problem with managing the radio spectrum is, let's all get together and make the best possible judgments. On the other hand, we have questions like the movement of polluted materials, the movement of contraband, the movement of people, the movement of semi-slaves, the movement of prostitutes, the movement of money illegally all around the world. And the collection of nations can't deal with that until they move to an agreed-on overall control system. Now, the UN has been particularly interesting as it's inched forward very, very slowly, agonizingly slowly in the minds of some people, but at a meteoritic pace for others, in learning to deal with conflict. Earlier, it was ready to stand guard during an armistice. Then it was ready to go in and do more aggressive peacekeeping. And now it's moving toward peacemaking. And now, with regard to Iraq, a large portion of the UN is going to be ready to move in and take peremptory action. Now, you see, what's happening is it's the pressure of these issues that cannot be dealt with by the nation level that's going to lead to the inevitability of global government. Now, it doesn't have to be framed on a model we're familiar with. It could be framed on the whole variety of models that have yet to be developed. So the other point about e-communication is very interesting, because what effectively the electronic network is the largest open library that has ever existed, where the authors or the would-be authors or the soon-to-be authors or the writers or the non-writers can all get together and exchange ideas and meet 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000 people and communicate with them who share an interest with them. Now, that's absolutely unprecedented. And what's going to happen out of that as it gets more and more sophisticated, as the rough edges of it get burnished away, is that we're going to have more and more intense interest in important subjects by massive populations of people around the world. Now, massive, I don't mean 3, 4, 5 billion, but the issues that are going to concern people could very well involve millions of people, right? Not billions. And that's going to lead to more and more judgments and discussions among them, more creative development of alternatives, more sense of what the real feeling about what could be done, longer-term discussion about what possibilities are, and so on. And so as all that occurs, I don't see these people voting. The electronic voting in the political sense doesn't make much sense. But surveys, all kinds of evaluations, and so on, that will become so absolutely routine and ordinary in the sense that people will be involved with it, that that's really got to foment the democratic process.
Speaking with Joseph Coates, he's been a consulting futurist for 40 years and is recently the author of 2025 Scenarios of U.S. and Global Society Reshaped by Science and Technology. You're listening to Change Surfer Radio, and I'm Dr. J. You think that there's going to be an increasing development of a global middle class But there's also going to be this group of countries which are going to be increasingly worse off, basket case countries, and this level of global governance or global participation. In European and a lot of third world societies, the project of left politics has hit a wall with globalization, that because capital is able to escape all around the world. Do you think that the creation of these global institutions will allow a new redistributive or Keynesian vision at a global level?
It's an interesting question, and I think the vocabulary reflects how outmoded, antediluvian the terminology is. The package needs to be unwrapped and resorted. But back to the question, I think what happens in many cases is that the local effects of a global involvement tend to get intense local attention, because there is no way of bringing the global constituency to bear on the issue. You see this most clearly in the United States, in which we take actions virtually every day in the U.S. Congress and in the executive branch through the various agencies that it runs that affects millions of people around the world. Yet our Constitution very carefully precludes them from having any say in what we do. The only way we hear about Nepal or Zaire or China or Colombia or Venezuela or Brazil is through American interests, and therefore you're already looking at the situation in those countries through a very, very distorting mirror or a very distorting microscope. And hence, our political process tends to get carried off in pretty screwy directions. Hence, there's a lot of hostility and dislike and even hate for the United States around the world. So the problem is not to blame left-right. The problem is to say, in our own polity, how can we get a better understanding in a timely fashion of what those millions and even billions of people we're going to affect think? And that's the political issue ahead of us.
I'm of course, this show is about the politics of future technology, so I've been asking a lot of political questions. But your book and the scope of your consulting practice is in all kinds of fields, and your book has chapters on housing and space and health and productivity and all kinds of things.
Sure.
Let me ask in a different area then, which is still everything's political, but this is still political. You talk in your book about the use of genetics, and you say that you do think that enhancement will be public policy, that human genetic enhancement will be public policy in some countries such as China, and that other countries may encourage gene counseling through tax incentives.
Let's say within the next 10 or 12 years, we develop some fundamental understanding about the neuronal aspects of human intelligence. Suppose, for example, this concept of G, a generalized intelligent factor separate from your individual aptitudes, turns out to be something we can identify and establish has a neurological base. The neurological base is going to be basically genetically driven. And that will say, now, can we get in and deal with and correct people who are, in some sense, G deficient, less intelligent than they could be? Now, once you have that capability, then you automatically have to think about, well, could I carry them past making them normal and make them supernormal? Now, supernormal might only be making them from an IQ of 100 to an IQ of 120, or an IQ of 120 to an IQ of 140. But what would happen if a whole mass of the population benefited from that enhancement? It would have tremendous effects on the economy. Now, I don't think we're going to do that in the United States first off. But I would say a good candidate country would be North Korea, or South Korea, where the people are homogeneous, they have a strong sense of their role in the international world, they're tremendously driven for success, they're extremely intelligent in the sense of functional intelligence, you know, they really do a great job at what they set out to do, and they could very well decide on a national policy of raising the IQ 2 points per generation, or maybe 4 points per generation. Now, would that create the parallel of the missile gap? You know, after they'd fiddled around with this for 10 or 15 years, and we saw that it didn't bring about significant and substantial damage, that there weren't major negative side effects, then other countries would say, maybe we have to close the IQ gap. Now, that's just one scenario about how it might come about. The other side, though, is how do people respond to new capabilities in the framework of their ideological pre-commitments? And let's take the case of people who are absolutely opposed to abortion. And let's say routine genetic testing that might be instituted by law as a public health measure says that this woman is going to carry a child who is mongoloid, or this woman is carrying a child who is going to have some serious physical disorder, and it's uncorrectable right now. Now, with that information in hand, the way things are now set up, we would just counsel that person, tell them what some choices are, and let them make the decision. But now let's jump ahead and suppose we have the capability now to intervene intrauterinely and enhance, correct, deal with that really life-stymieing disorder. Now you move the public policy issue to an entirely new framework. If that fetus in utero grows and is born without any change, the lifelong cost to society, the cost to the child itself set aside, might be $900,000. It might be $1.2 million with all the provisions for care and so on. And yet the process of intervention is 99.5% reliable and would bring that child to a degree of normality that it would be a functioning citizen. The public policy issue that emerges out of that is what can we do to urge, nudge, push, but not absolutely force that parent to make a different decision? And the idea is the law might get a bit punitive about that. If you refuse to take the intervention that will enhance the child, then we cut you and the child off from any federally supported health benefits.
Well, Joe, there's enough in your book for 10 or 20 radio shows, but let me ask one last question. We have about a minute or two. If a student wanted to get involved in futurism, future studies, would you recommend that they go to a place that has a future studies program, or could they pursue futurism and become a futurist through any field?
Well, you can get to it through any route. All the doors are still open, but you'd have to work pretty hard at it. I think if you wanted to get a master's degree, the best place to do it would be at the University of Houston in Clear Lake or at the University of Honolulu in Hawaii. They both have master's degree level futures programs, and they're very good. On the other hand, you might decide that you're interested in the future, and you might want to get to work with some futures firm as an intern, as a low-level grunt, or whatever, to just get a better taste of the water, see if you really like it. And there are at least a dozen futures firms in the U.S. that are large enough to be hiring some people at the junior level or at the intern level, or even a temporary job over a summer or something like that. But there are ways to sample the water.
Thanks so much for being with us. I've been talking with Joseph Coates. His book, 2025, Scenarios of U.S. and Global Society Reshaped by Science and Technology, we've been discussing. And you can find Joe at josephcoates.com. It's C-O-A-T-E-S is the Coates. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Dr. J.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.